Okay. Hi, I'm Ralf. Helmut is not here this week, he's in Dachstuhl. So I will do the lecture today. And tomorrow I'm doing an exercise. But the regular exercises start next week. And the first worksheet is already online. And yeah. Next Monday is a holiday, so the exercise groups are Monday 12 o'clock and Wednesday 10 o'clock. But since it's a holiday, I'll do a group on Tuesday at 5 o'clock. Is that okay? Yeah.
Tuesday is still a holiday.
Is it? Yeah, well then, I don't know, then Wednesday and maybe Thursday. But I don't know what time. I don't care. Okay, so Wednesday 10 o'clock is anyway, and then let's do Thursday 10 o'clock. Is that okay? Yeah? Who's not okay with this? Well, what's better?
Evening.
Okay, let's see hands for Thursday 10 o'clock. Okay. 12 o'clock?
2 o'clock?
3? No. Well, who has a problem with 10 o'clock? Only you?
Not me
too. But 2 o'clock is okay for you and for you?
I've got to be in the main campus.
Yeah. So and what about Wednesday?
From morning until 4.
And Wednesday?
Wednesday is fine.
Well, then,
perfect.
It's okay. Then let's do Thursday 2 o'clock.
Nice.
Okay? So that's 24. But that's only for next week, so usually it's Monday and Wednesday. So, who's not on Moodle yet? Everybody? Okay.
This one is for both groups, or it's only for one group on 24th. It's exercise for Monday and Wednesday group, or it's...
But it's just one group a week, and then you can choose between these two dates.
On 24th is for both of them?
Depends when you got time. I don't care.
It's up to you.
Yeah.
The same thing will be repeated on Wednesday.
Yeah. No. I hope it's somehow even. Most of them. Okay. Yeah, tomorrow I'll just recap the stuff we already did so far in the lecture and show you the VAM a little bit and that you can use for the exercises then. And yeah. Any more questions? No? Oops. Yeah. Okay, so far we did some different virtual machines, and the first one was for C, something like C, and yeah, we have a stack and a code storage. And then we did some simple expression stuff, binary operations. Okay, we have L values, R values. That should be familiar to everybody. And maybe what's important here is if you have a constant, then you just load it. And if you see that you have a variable here that's in the address environment, oops, then you have to load the address, and that row keeps just the relative address of this variable. and then you can load that. So you see here code R of a variable is loading the address, or getting the address on the stack, and then issuing the load instruction. And that's for storing. Okay, then we have statements. If then, okay. Okay, we had while loops. For loops is pretty much extended while loop. And then Helmut stopped at the switch statement. And the main thing here is that you can do branching in constant time. For example, if you do it with if, then else, then you have to check for every value in your range. For example, you have an enum that's n values, and then you have n comparisons. And with the switch statement, you just use the value and then jump to that case for that value. So you save some instructions. And what we need here is the jump I instruction, and it takes an address and then an index on the stack, and then jumps to the base address plus the index. Okay, and the switch statements that we look at here are somehow simple form, because we make sure that it starts with zero, is ordered as a default case, and breaks for every case, which need not be in usual C programs. Yeah. And that's the code. That's the expression we switch on, and then we have to check if that expression, if the value is in the range for the cases we have. So we generate, I should use this. So here we have a jump table, and that contains all the addresses of the different cases. So C0 to CK, where CK is the default case. And then this check macro makes sure that the expression is inside these 0 to K, because otherwise we could jump somewhere else to a different code that we don't want. And yeah, we could put that jump table here too, but here you don't know yet the addresses, because let's say the case 0 has 5 instructions, and then the C1 would be, well, the starting address of C1 depends on how many instructions the case before it has. Okay. Yeah, and these jump D that are just the break statements. Okay. Any questions? No. And now we look at the check macro here. And I don't know, the dub instruction wasn't introduced. It's here. It just takes the value on top of the stack and duplicates it. And we have to use that because the comparison would otherwise eat up the value. But we still need it for the jump I here. So let's say we have the expression we switch on here, and then we duplicate it, and it's here too. And then here we check for if it's greater or equal than 0. So 0, and then we do the comparison, and then we have here either 1 or 0. And below the E, and then jump 0. That means if it's below 0, then we jump to the to here, which basically just takes this off the stack and then loads the default value. That's the default case, the K, and then it does the jump. And that's pretty much the same, just for the other end. It checks if it's less than K. and otherwise it jumps to K. Okay. Oh yeah, that's what I already said. It's the switch is, you have a lot of possibilities for optimizing it, and generally it's not the case because it doesn't matter that much, but you could assume that you have the first case is at, let's say, zero, and then in between you have nothing, and then you have the last case is 1,000, and then you would still need to generate a jump table that's 1,001 entries long. And maybe you don't want to do it because it's too much space or something. And that's why it could be that the compiler has some heuristics and still does an if then else instead of the switch. Or it could do a branching beforehand. For example, there are some dense regions until, I don't know, 100 and then here 900 to. And then it could branch to here and do a switch for these and for these. Okay?
Yeah, I currently be assuming that we go from 0 to k. And for example, if I have now a switch statement which is not in an order form like 0, 1, 2, 3, and is it then still faster? Or
what's faster?
Because now we can say we are in constant time.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If we don't have something like a linear order.
Well, that's the compiler can just sort it. You don't care. Well, I don't know. You have to pass it anyway, so you could sort it when you pass it, I guess. And yeah, depends. I don't know. If you do if then else, then you have n comparisons, and if you have to sort it first, then it might be an n log n or something. I don't know.
So does it depend on the how the compiler is designed?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. And yeah, if you are sure that the values are in this range, then you don't need to do the check. That could be, for example, if you have an enum, let's say for weekdays, and then you are sure that if your switch has all the weekdays in it and the type doesn't allow any other values, then you are sure that it's inside this range, so you don't need to check. Ah, yeah. And if it starts, for example, not at zero, then you just have to subtract the first, the minimal case value.
Yeah, I mean, for example, if zero or some
That doesn't matter because then you don't jump to them, but you still need the entries in the jump table. So, yeah, that's what I said here. For example, you have a case 0 and then one case 100, and then you evaluate it, and if it's 0, then you go in the jump table at index 0 and jump somewhere. And if it evaluates to 100, you jump to somewhere. And if it's somewhere in between, then you jump to the default case because all the other entries that don't have a case in the switch jump to the default. But you still need all the entries in the jump table. Yeah.
Well, if you have like a case 0 and a case, let's just say, integer max value, you have like a 2 gigabytes long entries, and if each entry is like 4 bytes, you have like 8 gigabytes.
Yeah, that's why the compiler usually has some stuff he does to optimize it. For example, if you have 2 values, then it's probably just doing an if then else instead of the switch. Or it tries to identify some regions that are densely populated and then does branching and 2 extra switches for them. My prime number?
Because it's pretty difficult to separate them
what some compilers do is also just build a hash table, and then it doesn't matter. It just jumps, looks up the value in the hash table, and jumps to that. Okay, now for storage, any more questions for the switch? No? Okay, we had the address environment here, and up until now it's all statically determined, the addresses. And you can do that, for example, in a C program, you take all the global declarations, and then you have some functions, for example here main, and then you have some declarations in there, and then you just go through and then assign in row the starting from one the addresses. And we have to note here that all the basic types just occupy one storage cell, so that's a simplification. And yeah, it's starting at one, it's also important. So for example, if you have some declarations here, let's type one, variable one, up until k, and those are all basic types, then the entries in row are just I. So for the first variable, I have relative address one, second two, and so on. But that's just for the basic types here. Okay, and arrays are not a basic type, they are larger than one. And you have a type for the entry here, and then how many entries you need. So here we have an array of 11 components, which then needs 11 cells, because int takes one cell. Okay. And here we have the size of operator, like in C. And for basic types, that's the notation. So for example, int is one. And for arrays, we have k times the size of the base type. And that t prime could be, I don't know, a struct or something, so it could be larger than one. That's why you have to multiply k times in the size of the entry. And that's the more general form then for the addresses. For the basic ones, we just had one, two, and so on. And here we have to look for variable I, what the address was for variable I minus one, and then plus its size, and then we have the new address for xi. Yeah, and this all can be computed at compile time. Okay, and now for the code R and code L, something about arrays in C is that the R value of the array is just the starting address of the first element. And that's why when you want to access a certain index, you have to take the address of the array, that's the first element, and then plus size of one element times the index. So we have here for the address of element E of array A, We have to load the base address of the array, and then we have to evaluate the index, and then we have to load the size, which we know at compile time, and then we just multiply these two and add it to the base address. Okay?
During the evaluation of the index, what's happening?
Well, that's just an expression, so you use your code R for that and get value. And other cases, for example, if it's not the right type, then the compiler should, or type checker should warn you beforehand.
Oh, that's the evaluation.
Well, type checking should happen before, so if you have dynamic typing, then you just have a runtime error. Okay, and that's the more general form here, because the because the that could also be an expression, the first part, and then you have to evaluate that, and then the index, and then load, multiply, add. And something funny here about C is that that I already said the code R is equal to the code L, but here that's also legal in C because the type checker just sees that that's the array, and then it scales this one here by this instead of this. Okay? So it basically those two probably get transformed to something like that, and then he checks which one is a pointer and then which one is an integer and just adds the address. But you shouldn't write that, that's strange. Okay. Okay, now for structures. Everything clear with arrays? In some language they are called records, and basically the difference to arrays is that you can have different types. An array is just one type times, I don't know, okay. And here you have, I don't know, maybe int, and then, I don't know, we don't have anything else than int, but maybe a different struct or something. So you can have different types, and these are identified by field names. And here's an example for C. Here you define a struct that's safe or already declared as the variable x. And you do a type def because C has nominal typing, not structural typing. That means maybe you want to use that kind of struct somewhere else, and then it's handy to have the type defined, because otherwise the compiler doesn't know that those two instances are the same, because it doesn't compare the structure. For example, if you copy that line and then you have here y, then the compiler doesn't know that those two are the same, or it doesn't regard them as the same, because it just sees two different declarations and it doesn't check the structure. Okay. Yeah. And for this struct, the relative address is the first field inside it. And then for the fields inside, you have relative addresses to the start of the struct. So for A, for example, here we have offset 0. And for B, we have offset 1 because A is an int. Here we do something strange. We say we have all those field names must be unique across the whole program, and we can just put them in the address environment without having to care about them. But probably you should do something like, I don't know, maybe put the struct type in front and then the field name, then you can have the same field names for different structs. And here we see how the size is calculated. So we have to go through all the fields of the struct here from 1 to k, and then just add the sizes of the fields together, and that gives you the total size of the struct. And for the offsets for the fields inside, you start with 0, and then for the I, you start where you left at the i minus one field. So for example, we have here an E that evaluates to a struct and C, which is a field inside that struct. Then you have to get the code L, that means the address of this struct, and then load from the address environment the relative offset of field C, and then add it to the base address you got here, and then you have the address for that field. Okay? Yeah.
So what about having two structs which have the same name at a different address? The address environment doesn't seem to reflect this possibility here. So if you have one struct where, for example, you've got a member called X which is at address 1, and another struct which has an X which is at address
8. Yeah, that's okay. That's this here. We just assume that they're unique, all those names. And yeah, that's not really good, but it's not much of a hassle to implement something like local address environment for each struct type. And then you can look up the type of the struct, and then inside there the relative field name. Okay, here's an example with an address environment. So we have struct that's kept in variable x, and then we have for x the relative address 13, so we have to load that. And then we want to have field B, and then we look here in the address environment, and you see here that's global, all those field names are also kept in the row address environment, and we just have to make sure that if there's a different struct, then the field names can't have the names A and B. And since we have that invariant, we can just use the B here, get its relative address, which is 1, and then add it, and then we have here 14 for the field B of struct X. Okay. So far, any questions? Okay, the next important thing is that all was statically declared variables, but you can also have dynamically managed storage. And the main difference is that it's not kept on the stack. That means if you leave, I don't know, maybe you go in a function, and then when you return from the function, all those local variables are removed from the stack. And maybe if you want to keep a variable between different function calls, you have to either use global variables, or you could put it on the heap. So that's an alternative storage area. And the stack grows from 0 to here. And the heap, well, you don't know how big the stack or the heap will get. Or maybe you can, yeah, for the heap you don't know. And that's why you have to grow from the other side. So the heap grows from here. And the new pointer is the lowest occupied heap cell. So if you do a malloc and you want to get a new storage space in the heap, then you get it at the new pointer here, and then the pointer is decreased because it grows to the bottom. And now the problem is that every time the stack pointer or the new pointer changes, you have to make sure that they don't collide, because otherwise you have a stack overflow, or I don't know, it's bad. You don't want it. And you also don't want to check every time the stack pointer changes, because that happens basically all the time, because we don't use registers but the stack. And then every time you do some operation, you probably change the stack pointer, and you would have to check every time if it's now colliding with the new pointer. And that's why you have some worst case pointer here, which is called the extreme pointer. And this points to the uppermost cell, which the stack pointer can point to in a function. And that you can determine statically. And then you only have to check when you change the new pointer. That means if you do a malloc, then you have to check if after the malloc the new pointer would be lower than the extreme pointer, then the malloc would fail and you would return null, not enough storage. And yeah, maybe for this extreme pointer here, you have to take the maximum possible stack size. So for example, if you have in your program if, and you go here and here, and then here you, I don't know, have load C something, and here you have the same times 5, then the extreme pointer would be the maximum of those two branches, and then when you join, so it's, or the join operator for those branches is the maximum, so you would take the 5 times the whatever you put on the stack. Is that clear?
No? We do not have recursive functions right now.
No.
Okay.
Yeah, that's, it comes later. Okay, so basically this extreme pointer is just an optimization, so we don't have to check every time we change the stack pointer if it's colliding with the new pointer. Yeah, so they grow towards each other. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and here we see the, well, you know the malloc from C. It's not really in the C language, but in the library, but we just assume it. Oh no, it's part of the language. And here we have an expression, which is the size of memory we want to get. And then we have to evaluate that number, and then the new instruction gives us that memory if there is enough memory. But if the new pointer minus e would be lower than the extreme pointer, then we just return null. And well, as a C programmer, you would have to check every time for a malloc if it returns null, because it could be that there's not enough storage. And then, I don't know, shut down or something. Okay, so we have pointers now, and those can, well, they point to, well, something strange about C is that they can, if you have a pointer, it's not necessarily to the heap. It can also point to the stack. And then if it's, I don't know, if the stack is gone but your pointer has escaped, then it points to nowhere. So you have a dangling pointer, so you have to take care that you only point to stuff that's still there. And in the heap, it just keeps being there until you free it. Yeah, okay, so a pointer points to somewhere. And if you want to get the value to of the thing it points to, we have to dereference the pointer. And malloc gives us such a area on the heap and returns the pointer to it. And now if we want to have the address of a variable, there's this address operator here, and the code R of this address operator of an expression is just the expression itself. So, yeah, maybe you saved that somewhere here, you got the pointer, and then you put it somewhere in a variable, and here you get the address again. Okay, and here's the new instruction. So on the top of the stack, there's the size we want to have. And then it just checks if this here, the new pointer minus this n is smaller or equal to the extreme pointer, then we have to return null. And otherwise, we just set the new pointer, which is here, size n, and then return on the stack the new pointer. So that's the address to it. Yeah, null is the same as zero. Okay, and now if you have a pointer, you dereference it, that means you get the content with this star here, and the address of an expression dereferenced is the same as the expression evaluated. Yeah. So here's an example. We have a struct. Okay. And inside is an array and another pointer to the same struct. So we have an array here, and then here we have a pointer to the same thing, possibly. And then we have here two global variables, I don't know, and then an instance of a pointer to that struct. And in C you have these arrows, which are syntactically, well, just some other way of writing that here. So whenever you see an arrow, it's the first part dereferenced and then a field access. So if we want to translate this here, we have to evaluate this and then look up the field offset of A, which is zero, and then add it. But I guess the example is that's some visualization of it. So this is a pointer to the struct, and that's the first struct and the array here, and then a pointer to a second struct. And here's a bigger example. So that's our address environment, and we want to have, oh my god, B. So we have, here's one struct and here's the other, so that's the B, and then here we want to have the A, which is the array, and here we want to have the I plus 1 component. So first we have to look what's the outermost thing we want to generate code for, and that's the array access here. So we have the index here, and that's the first part, that's the array base address. And then since that was an integer array, we have size of the element is 1, multiply it by the index, and then add it to the base address. So okay, load A1 is because I is the relative address of I is 1, and this load A just loads It's a short form for load C, 1 and then load. So it loads this I, and then it loads a 1, adds it, so we have this part here, and then we multiply it by the size. So we have this already handled, and then we need the left side, which is this. Okay, let's see. And A was, can I go back? What? So A was at 0, it's a field, and it's the first field, that's why the relative address is 0. So we have that here, we add it, and then we have just this left, and this is just the PT is at 3, so we have load A3, and then we have the access to B, which is here B at 7, and then we add those two, then we have this part, and then that's just the rest. We load, we have the address here. That's the address we calculated, and then since it's a dereference, we have to do the load here. That's important. And then we have loaded the struct, and then we access the, what was it, A? Yeah. And then we have this. Oh. Okay. That's just a summary. We have, that's for arrays. So we have to take the first part and then the part in the brackets and multiply it with the size and then add it. And we just assume here that it's always this form and not some form where the integer is in the first place. That's here. We just assume that it, the first part is the array. And then for structs, we have the address of the struct and then relative to it the field and add it. And for dereferencing, we just keep the R value of the expression as the address. And that's the address of some variable x, which is in row, so we look x up in row, and then just load c, so we have the address on the stack. And for the r value of the address operator of e, we just take the address of e. So address operator is address of e. And for some other expression, the R value is the L value if E is an array. So for arrays, we have R value equals L value equals pointer to the first element of the array. And then for other binary operators, we just have code R first, second, and then the operator. And constants, R value of a constant is just load C, the constant. R value of an variable, well, you have to look up if it's a constant or a variable, but that that you can do if you once you pass it. And here for assignments, you have the R value of the right-hand side, and then you need the address of the left-hand side, and then you just use this. That store instruction, which takes the E2 and puts it into the cell pointed to by E1. And that's for all other cases that are not handled above. We just load the address, whatever that result is. much time do we have left? Yeah. Okay. Here's another example. You have an array of size 10, and that's, I don't know, that's the address environment. And then we want to have for the cell that's pointed to by the base address of the array, we want to put 5 in there. And so we need to get the address of this, which is just the R value of A. And this is the L value of A, because A is an array. And then we just look it up in the address environment, and we get 7 as the address. And then we load the right-hand side here, and then we load the address of the left-hand side into the store. And since here is a semicolon, it's a statement, so we have to pop what's left on the stack, which is the this one. It's an exercise translate. Yeah, well, here's more stuff. But we can practice some of that tomorrow. So everybody should bring, I don't know, laptop maybe. And well, I don't know. The first worksheet is due next week, so we don't have anything to do, and I don't want to go through all the slides. I don't know if it's Helmut should do that better, and so I'll just do some exercise. And so it will be something like that, I guess. Maybe something a little bit more complicated. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, and that's just this example. I don't need to go through that now. Okay, and so we know how to allocate storage, and then obviously you have to free it somehow, otherwise you run out of memory. And well, if you lose your pointers, then you have some dangling references and you can't free it, and then it just gets freed once the program terminates. And yeah, one problem with freeing the storage is that you don't free it in a nice way, but it could be freed, I don't know, all over the place, and then you get fragmentation of your memory. So you can either trust a programmer to do it right and manage some lists for it, but that's expensive, or you could just do nothing, but then you run out of memory eventually. And or you could do garbage collection, which happens at runtime, and then usually you have to pause the program, and the garbage collector comes in and looks what has no references to it. And for example, you have here a cell with some pointers to it, and this one doesn't have any pointers to it left, and then the garbage collector says, okay, this one can be freed. But that's, first it's complicated, and second it's a runtime performance hit, and for some applications, I don't know, embedded you, well, usually for embedded you don't use dynamic memory at all, because it's just too, I don't know, too complicated and too slow, and you don't want it. And yeah, so you can do garbage collection, or you can, so that runs in certain time slots and then looks what can be freed. Or you can rely on Objective-C as some automatic counting of references, so it happens at compile time, automatic reference counting. Yeah. And then the compiler knows at which point you can free something. But yeah, that's also runtime performance impairment because it inserts some checks. Okay. Well, I can just say we have functions. I don't want to go into that too much now. Yeah, maybe something general. We are looking at C, so we just have globals, global declarations, and then normally we have a main function, and then we have some other functions. I don't know. And those can have parameters, those functions, and return type. And inside they have some statements. And the variables you allocate here statically are either local variables of those functions. And once those, so you have some space here in the stack for this function. And then once the function is done, you just throw away everything that was. You save a pointer where the function started, and then everything that's allocated by the function you throw it away once the function returns. And yeah. But that's just for the variables that are declared here, because the globals are just alive for the whole program. Okay? Yeah, and that's an example for a factorial function. Here's the C code for that function, and then here we have some temporary variable where we store the result in, and then we print it. So the n is a local variable of the main function, so it will be thrown away later, and the same for the parameters of those functions, those are also wiped off the stack then. Yeah.
Can I just add a short question to the heap and stack B?
Yeah.
We said on the one hand that the heap grows from higher addresses to low.
Yeah. Well, it's an implementation decision. We start with a stack from zero, and then the other end must be the heap. It's
okay.
Just you have two ends, it doesn't matter.
Okay, and the extreme pointer, we say that we change the extreme pointer in the stack, because then we can already define the extreme pointer always at compile time, right? So it's less, it costs less if you do it at the stack than on the heap.
I don't know what you. The problem is that every time the stack pointer changes, you have to check, basically if it runs into the new pointer, and if you have an upper limit for the stack pointer which it can reach, which is the extreme pointer, then you don't have to do it every time the stack pointer changes, but only every time the new pointer changes, and this happens much less than the stack pointer change.
Okay.
So this extreme pointer is just an upper bound where the stack pointer could reach inside a certain function.
Yeah, right, and because the heap is dynamic, we cannot say at compile time where the extreme pointer is, if the extreme pointer
Yeah, sure.
And on the stack, we can already define it at compile time, right?
Yeah, that's the point. Because all we did before the dynamic memory was statically declared variables, and then you can, well, the name already implies it, it's static, that means basically not at the runtime, but you can do it beforehand. You can find out what what will be the highest stack pointer that you could reach. Yeah.
But now with functions we can implement recursion, and this breaks our mechanism of automatically calculating the maximum stack size. We cannot do this now anymore.
Well, you have, if you have a recursive function, the you can say for the, let's say we have an f here, and then inside we have another f. Then you have the extreme pointer for this body. And the thing is, no, it's for the declaration of the function. But I guess, for example, you put some stuff on the stack here, and then you have some extreme pointer up until the recursive call. And then after the recursive call, that's the point, everything on the stack will be gone except the return value. Because you throw away all the local stuff. Ah, yeah, sure.
Propagate what the maximum stack size would be.
Well, you can propagate it for each call, and then once you run out, well, that's just a stack overflow.
Yes.
If you have a recursive function without, if you don't detect tail recursion, then, and you run infinitely long, then you just run out of stack space. I don't know exactly, but could be. Yeah.
We cannot calculate the definite maximum size. So what we do is just being pessimistic and adding some space.
That's something you could do, and then, well, the problem is you would have to be ultimately pessimistic because you don't check anymore because of the extreme pointer. So I'm not sure what happens then. No. Yeah. That's really important, but I guess Helmut will repeat that next week then. We have the stack pointer here, and then we have a function pointer that points to some organizational cells, and those hold the old program counter where you were before the function call, and then the old frame pointer, which is I haven't seen that, but that's the solution to the EP thing. You keep an old extreme pointer in the on the stack here, and then you can just, in a recursive call, add to that, I guess. And the frame pointer, that's the point where you left off, and then you throw away everything up until that frame pointer. Yeah, that's the last organizational cell. And the parameters, you have a frame pointer, and then you can use it relatively to address local variables and formal parameters of the function. And yeah, positive are the local variables, and negative are the parameters of the function. Yeah, and that's you need that because some functions can have a variable number of arguments, and then you just need some place where you can say below that parameters, and everything above that is the new local space for the function. Yeah, and for the parameters, since you don't need them at the end anymore, you can just use one of them to put the return value in of that function. Yeah, and that's what I mentioned earlier. Basically, you have to differentiate between globals and locals in C, and the parameters are part of the local environment of the of function. And then for the address environment, you just have to put a tag to the variables if they are global or local variable. Because then for function calls, you have to do certain things with the locals and with the globals, because inside the function you can only access the globals outside the function or the locals that you create or the parameters. Well, I guess we can stop. It's getting too complicated. Any questions, maybe? Nothing? No. So that's it, and I don't know, maybe tomorrow I show some examples for the function calls or something. Because all the, I don't know, well, you can tell me then what you want to do. I guess the array and structure stuff is pretty easy once you practice it once or twice, I don't know. But the function call stuff is more complicated, and maybe we'll do some of that then. Okay? No? I'm not.